I don't know, Steve. Is it?
It is for me.
Fundamental creative contact.
Yes, fundamental creative human contact. That's what it's all about here on Read Me Something You Love. And today we're going to be having that with the creatively galvanized and galvanizing Vera Chock, an actress and performance maker who's doing some incredible things with her live production company, Saltpeter. At the moment, developing an epic cross-art, time-based performance installation called Tonsatia, The Man Who Abandoned the World. I know Vera mainly from her epic cross-art, time-based performance installation cabaret Brautigan Book Club, which she set up and ran from Bethnal Green Working Men's Club on a monthly basis, all through 2012. So that's where we're going today, with a Brautigan-themed pod. But why Braut? What was the initial attraction of Richard Brautigan's work for her?
Because it spans so many years, it's really hard to, I don't think I can accurately describe what I initially felt. But I think of heartbreak, I think of beauty and melancholy, but this wonderful apparent simplicity in the way he describes things, in the way he expresses things, but they're so cutting and accurate, and it's as if he sees things. So it's that wonderful thing about art, isn't it, when you sort of go, oh my God, that's exactly how I feel or have felt, and someone else has made that difficult, inexpressible feeling something beautiful or something I can recognize, and so you don't feel so isolated. And at the same time, his ability to describe really simple things, but that just opens up huge vistas of, you know, in your brain and your soul, and you start imagining worlds or possibilities. So I guess there's something about him that's very familiar but also very exciting. Does that make sense? There's a lot of space in Brautigan. He gives you space, and then he gives you the thing that aggravates an oyster. The thing that just sets you off, yes, to kind of to go in your direction. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move into that gritty space. let's work on that, on creating that kind of podcast oyster, which all of these podcasts are. You know, we get gritty, and then you get this oyster, half an hour sort of oral oyster, surely. This kind of comes out of that, no?
yes, absolutely.
You had to say that. So we're reading from, I was almost going to say Trautmann's Replica, but that's another kind of intrinsic, essential cultural, what's the word?
Fast and Bulbous.
That's right, the mascara snake. Fast and Bulbous. Also, a tin teardrop.
Bulbous also tapered.
That's right.
Cornerstone.
There we go. Thank you.
Thing.
I was just. You were gesturing. Doing this thing with my hand. Doing something very phallic with my hand, and then you rather politely interpret that as cornerstone. It's a cultural cornerstone. Trout fishing in America.
Yes.
And you're going to read for us the last couple of pages.
Yes. Now, spoiler alert.
Yeah, maybe not. People who have read it, this would be me, so long ago that I've almost forgotten it, or for people who have never read it, is there anything we need to know before we hear the last three pages of Trout Fishing, just in terms of, I mean, just very briefly in terms of...
Oh gosh, need to know anything, but basically it's an interesting book because it's episodic, and when I've read it a couple of times, the first time I didn't really enjoy it because I like narrative, so it didn't seem to be a through line. It's just these little short paragraphs which are slightly absurd, just a bit surreal, and you go, well, what's going on? And then the second time I read it, completely forgotten the ending. And I think someone said it's got such a good ending, and to be fair, I think most I mean, his writing is great. It's really taut, it's really crafted. He writes very good endings. And when I read it the second time, the ending just blew me away. So it feels as if there's no thread from beginning to end. But when you get to the end, suddenly it just goes in your head and you think, wow. I mean, that's what happened to me. I mean, I can't promise it's going to happen to everyone who reads it.
So that's interesting, because we're getting like those final resounding chords of a sort of the symphonic piece, but without the symphony, aren't we? Is what you're doing today. You're giving us the ending, but without the build-up.
But you see, it's not specific to the book either. I think by chance, like, these last three pages kind of reflect what he's all about.
Okay.
All his work seems to... Yeah, this seems to indicate the things he cares about and the way he writes and the style and the people he cares about, yeah. So I think I've chosen quite well, Steve.
I have absolute faith that you have chosen splendidly, as your splendid choices usually are.
I think you'll connect with it.
Okay.
I could have guessed that.
Great. Let's maybe have the last three pages of Trout Mask.
No! Trout Fishing in America. Yes, and I'll read out the chapter headings as well. So, prelude to the mayonnaise chapter. The Eskimos live among ice all their lives, but have no single word for ice. Man, His First Million Years by M.F. Ashley Montague. Human language is in some ways similar to, but in other ways vastly different from, other kinds of animal communication. We simply have no idea about its evolutionary history, though many people have speculated about its possible origins. There is, for instance, the bow bow theory, that language started from attempts to imitate animal sounds, or the ding dong theory, that it arose from natural sound producing responses, or the poo poo theory, that it began with violent outcries and exclamations. We have no way of knowing whether the kinds of men represented by the earliest fossils could talk or not. Language does not leave fossils, at least not until it has become written. Man in Nature by Marston Bates. But no animal up a tree can initiate a culture. The simian basis of human mechanics in Twilight of Man by Ernest Albert Houghton. Expressing a human need, I always wanted to write a book that ended with the word mayonnaise. The Mayonnaise Chapter. February 3rd, 1952. Dearest Florence and Harve, I just heard from Edith about the passing of Mr. Good. Our heart goes out to you in deepest sympathy. God's will be done. He has lived a good long life, and he has gone to a better place. You were expecting it, and it was nice you could see him yesterday, even if he did not know you. You have our prayers and love, and we will see you soon. God bless you both. Love, Mother and Nancy. P.S. Sorry I forgot to give you the mayonnaise. You're welcome.
So we start with these...
Three quotes.
They seem... I'm imagining he's written them himself. They seem sort of kind of apocryphal academia.
Oh, really?
No? Marston Bates? Sort of slightly similar to Master Bates? No?
I think they're real books.
Do you think they're real? Okay.
We could look them up. We could have little footnotes in the podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, he could have. He could have. No, I think they're real books.
Okay. So what's going on in those...
What's going on in the quotes?
In the quotes. I mean, what sort of sticks out for you? What resonates with you in those?
The idea of language and communication and why... people try to reach other people and the ways in which they do.
Mm.
And how it's difficult to express things, even though they're everyday things like ice. If you're surrounded by ice as an Eskimo, how can you not have the word for ice? Having said that, I know there's that sort of thing where they've got a million words for snow. But yes, you know, what's the rationality behind communication? And this idea that humans, the third quote, no animal of tree can initiate a culture, this idea that human beings are special, and that separates us from animals, and we're not beasts because we write and have culture and all that kind of stuff, which is a little bit true and untrue.
Mm.
I don't think the separation is that great. I think a civilization is a veneer that we like to believe is much more secure. But I don't know if you know, but I did study anthropology, and so all of this stuff is, you know, things that I've spent a lot of time writing essays about.
And I wonder if Brautigan, which is after quoting,
mm-hmm.
you, whether he's made up the quotes or not, you then get his voice or a voice, which to me is almost sort of saying, well, you know, and maybe this is maybe I'm projecting my sort of skepticism about academia and the need for so much of it. Doesn't it sort of seem to be saying that, well, this is all very well and true, but it's also kind of hokum to some extent, because it's actually really, really basic, expressing a human need.
Yes.
And that need might be actually almost sort of
whimsical.
Whimsical need, or a need that doesn't really make sense to us. I mean,
it's not a fundamental need, you know.
Yeah.
It could just be, this is what I need to do today, and it'll change tomorrow.
I really need to say the word mayonnaise quite a few times.
Yes.
You know?
And you know, you've smiled saying that, and I think there's so much naughtiness and pleasure in that sort of overturning of the ridiculousness of our taking ourselves so seriously, in the sense. So yes, you've got all this serious academic language, and they're serious questions, and they're questions that a lot of us ask, and they're worth asking. Why are we here? Why are we special? Why do we speak? Why do we clothe ourselves? But I think what's incredible is he seems really self-aware. Yes, they're important questions, but then yes, we're also incredibly silly, and we want silly things, but they're very basic things, but there's so many conflicts, I think.
But within that silliness,
yes,
there is again that essential human need, which you introduced, that sense of that need for contact, that need for reciprocity, because I said the word mayonnaise and smiled, and you noticed that, and you smiled. And I was just thinking, because we've got this thing going where I, because we're both on Twitter, and I feel a compulsion every time I tweet to you to utilize your surname in some sort of cunning fashion.
Yes.
And I feel there's something mayonnaise-y about what I do. In fact, what other people, it seems like lots of people actually have this need to kind of take the name Chock and do something with it. But is it not, because I'm only thinking that now, seeing this, is it not that need to make some sort of fundamental creative contact with you? It's sort of saying, I see you, I take your name and I do something with it. And
I don't know, Steve. Is it?
It is for me.
Fundamental creative contact.
And there's something about the contact being very real when it becomes a creative contact, because it's not just I'm not just taking your name as is. I'm actually utilizing it,
and
putting something myself into it.
There's a couple of things that are quite interesting about that. Now you've mentioned it, because I find in daily life people don't tend to address people by their first name. So I wouldn't go, Steve, would you please hand me that mug? Because that's quite a formal thing. You kind of use someone's name in a formal context. And so I think it's really lovely that you use my name. And secondarily, you just said, by doing so, it's a statement of, I see you, I recognize you, and I'm saying something about our relationship in this playfulness, playful use of your name. And I really appreciate that. Because a lot about self-expression in the world is about being seen, isn't it? It's about, I'm here, I have a voice. Do other people feel the same way as I do? Are my thoughts valid? And I don't know whether you noticed, but the last word is mayonnaise, and it's misspelt on purpose.
Ah, okay.
Which is a double joke.
Yes.
And it makes me so happy.
Huh.
So it's a deliberate misspelling.
So why does the misspelling make you happy?
Because he sets it up. It's a clever writing thing. He sets it up as I've always wanted to end a book with the word mayonnaise. And then he chooses to have it in a very sort of... It's in a postscript of a letter that's fairly domestic. I know someone's died in the letter. Mm-hmm. But then it's like the main... The body of the chapter is someone's died... P.S. Sorry, I forgot to keep the mayonnaise. So that, again, that juxtaposition of something really serious and something really mundane, but with that playful self-knowledge of, yes, that acknowledgement of the ridiculousness and beauty and sadness in life. I think it's great. It's very clever. I think Brautigan is really a disciplined writer.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not there by chance.
I mean, people who don't like Brautigan, is his mayonnaise quality actually something that annoys them? That the sense that he, in a way, he is, they might say, he's chasing the mayonnaise. He's chasing the whimsical, quite often. And people are like, well, why is he so mayonnaise hungry?
It is interesting. It depends on what you... Because he definitely has a style. But, I mean, last night I read something by him, a poem, and it was shockingly violent and visceral. There's nothing whimsical about this bit of writing. So I think it depends on what you fixate upon when you go, okay... Maybe he's whimsical, maybe he's romantic, maybe he's misogynist. You know, you could just decide what kind of writer he is. But I suppose it, compared to the beat, he's not sort of very macho, visceral writer in general.
Mm.
But whimsy... Oh, I don't know. But I think he makes people uncomfortable. I think whimsy is an easy way out to describe how his simplicity allows for the space for people to be uncomfortable and to... That's what I was alluding to earlier, where he sort of aggravates things, or he sets things in motion within people. And if you if you respond, it can be quite sort of disturbing. You think, oh gosh, you know, it's a lot of it is very lonely and heartbreaking and awful and despairing, but at the same time a lot of it is incredibly beautiful, and you think, why haven't I experienced that kind of beauty? I know, you know, it's obsessing. It's that sort of gift that he gives of the space to imagine.
Mm. I mean, in this particular, the mayonnaise chapter, what I find sort of uncomfortable is,
yeah,
I don't really know what to do with this letter.
No.
Dear Florence and Harve, I just heard from Edith about the passing of Mr. Good. Is Mr. Good a character?
No, none of these people.
None of these people have been mentioned before?
No, I don't think so.
So what do you do with this letter?
I look at it as it is, because I haven't read this book for a few months. I look at it and I think, I notice the names are... I don't know if at the time they were names that evoked a certain kind of person, but to me, Florence, Harve, Nancy, Mr. Good, they seem sort of a bygone era.
Mm.
Mr. Good is such a character. Like, who was he? But it's evocative.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that someone has died, God's will be done. It harkens back to sort of an era where there was sort of maybe things seemed clearer or simpler. And so there's, he's built in, I think, about the loss. You were expecting it, and it was nice. You could see him yesterday, even if he did not know you. So that's so identifiable, whether or not we've experienced death in our lives. So it's very quickly he's evoked these feelings for these people, and also this feeling of loss. And what do I do with that? I don't need to do. I feel.
What do you feel?
I feel there are that people out there feel the same things. I think not all the time, but this is an instant. This is an example of a familiar, recognizable situation. Like, I haven't experienced anyone dying in this way at all, but it feels sad. And it feels comforting as well.
I wonder if the mayonnaise in some way...
Mm.
I keep on coming back to the mayonnaise, yeah. Sorry, because I
no,
just want to say
it
this.
It is called the mayonnaise chapter.
Yeah. I wonder if it's... kind of linking back to the ice thing, that you know that they live among the ice all their lives, but they have no single word for ice, and that we live among the mayonnaise, whatever the mayonnaise might be for you here. I'm not dictating what mayonnaise needs to stand as a stand-in for, but I feel it's a stand-in for something, or maybe not. That we live among the mayonnaise, and we don't have words for it. In other words. You know, when he says, sorry, I forgot to give you the mayonnaise, for me, it's almost like he's saying, sorry, I'm giving you my condolences, but there's something more I need to say to you. That's, for me, what the mayonnaise is.
Yes, I agree. You know, it's sustenance, it's edible, it's not edible in the sense that steak and potato is edible, but it's something that mother... because it's from Mother and Nancy, this letter. Something that Mother and Nancy thought to bring for Florence and Harve, and they forgot to leave the mayonnaise. And it's this thing, I care, and there's much more that I would like to say about the death of Mr. Good, or your loss, or our relationship, or the world. But this is a letter, and I don't know how to express myself, and... the fact that it's a postscript as well is quite nice. Because you could have just left it off. If you'd really had forgotten the mayonnaise, you could have... I don't know.
Well, I feel in some kind of a bleak way, and maybe not a bleak way, in some maybe very simple, direct way, that you have given me the mayonnaise today. And... I, which is something actually you're very good at doing, and I hope you continue to dispense your particular chalk brand of mayonnaise.
Chalk brand mayonnaise. That's
well nice. Into 2013 and beyond.
No, I quite like mayonnaise. I do. But no, I do think it. You're right. It is about sort of. It's representing. This stretch towards the world, towards other people, in a jar. God bless you both. Sorry I forgot to give you the mayonnaise.